This is Radical Love Life, an ongoing series of podcasts and special events where we explore faith outside the boxes. Hosted by Mark Dilcom and Kelly Wilson.
Hey, Kelly.
Hey, Mark.
How are you?
I'm pretty good. It's beautiful outside. It's like a week before Thanksgiving and it's like 70 degrees outside.
Isn't it crazy? It makes you want to run around in shorts, you know, dive in the leaves.
Yeah. And then call my senator to talk about global warming. But yes.
Yes. Something like that. Yes.
How are you?
I am always freaking awesome as always.
Awesome. Yes. Awesome. Yes. Great to hear.
Yep. Yep.
What are we going to talk about today?
Well, Kelly, we have a very special guest today. His name is Chris Furr. Hello, Chris.
Hey, how you doing?
Awesome. Awesome. We're glad to have you on the show. So let's get started by telling our listeners about you, sir. So it says on your bio that you attended the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where you graduated with a BA in religious studies and then went on to Duke University Divinity School. And then where you received a Master of Divinity in 2005. And you are now an ordained in Christian ministry with the Christian Church Disciples of Christ, which is never easy for me to say for some reason. And you've served churches over in England, Alexandria, and you are now in Cary, North Carolina. Is that correct, sir?
That's right. Yes, sir.
All right. Well, it's good to have you on the program with us. And you also, you wrote a book, and that's what we're going to talk about a little bit. It's called Straight White Male, came out last year, has a subtitle of A Faith-Based Guide to Deconstructing Your Privilege and Living with Integrity. And it was published by Westminster John Knox.
That's right.
That subtitle is pretty important. I showed it to my wife. I was like, this is what we're going to talk about today. And she's thought it was like some defense of, you know, straight white maleness. And I was like, no, look at this subtitle. Look, it's, we're breaking it down.
Yeah. I like that. I didn't quite get that. So talk to us about that title. Let's get started right there, Chris.
The main title I sort of had from the beginning, I knew it would be a provocative title, which is, good and bad, I guess, depending on how you receive it. But the subtitle we really worked at more, trying to make sure it gave, you know, context right to that initial part. And I think actually the word privilege has probably gotten the most attention out of all the words that are in that title, as far as the one that people react to the most. So I wanted it to be clear that it's undergirded with faith, with theology, with scripture, with it's not a necessarily just a social commentary. It's a way of framing the issue around the scriptural narrative and how that can help us understand the dynamics that are at work and what our calling is.
Absolutely. Did you tell us why you wrote the book?
Well, I thought that, you know, it came out of a lot of conversations that I was having with people like me who fit all those boxes. A lot of folks who understand, you know, the landscape that we're living in, and how, you know, that for the world that we live in, how the Black Lives Matter movement, how Me Too, how those things have changed our cultural awareness around these issues, and just wanting to do the right thing, but not sure what the right things are to say, what the right posture is to take, you know, understanding that there are years and years of injustices and inequalities that need to be dealt with, but also not understanding what our place is, you know, and what do we do with our own aspirations and goals, I guess, to be in places of leadership and authority. So there was like straight white men, you know, who wanted to do the right things in public, but in private were having conversations like, what is this? How do we do this? You know, what does this really mean? And how do I wear the body that I'm in? So I really wanted to sort of dive into that and say, okay, well, what does it mean to live in this body, in this moment, mm-hmm. when you care about justice.
Mm-hmm.
And so
as a straight white male,
exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. It's interesting how those conversations have changed over the years. I've done some writing and podcasting in those spaces over the last few years. And I remember years ago, it was all about, listening and education. And it's really like, we are really much further beyond that now, that it's not just straight white men listening and, you know, out of their benevolence being inclusive. There's a lot more to the, like, we're really being asked to change and radically change in order to deconstruct and not only ourselves, but the systems that we benefit.
Right. Yeah, exactly. What do we do with the knowledge we gain, right? When we listen to these cultural conversations and when we hear from folks in the culture who are telling us what their experience of the world is, and then what does that mean for us to, a lot of the things that we're hearing now, you know, things like the message of the Black Lives Matter movement, the Me Too movement, are things that people have been trying to say for a long time and trying to get us to listen. And so once you hear, then what's your responsibility once you've heard? So I think that's a great way of framing it.
Yeah. Right. So Chris, your own journey that led you to writing the book, obviously did your degree, your undergrad, and then went in to get your master's here as well in divinity at Duke. Mm-hmm. Was this a part of your journey of opening yourself up to what would be the reality of white privilege yourself? How do you define this in this time? So kind of walk us through that, your own journey there.
Yeah, well, I think it started, I think the seeds of this awareness were planted like way back when I was a kid. I had both my parents were in public education. And so I was raised with an awareness that not everybody's life is like mine. And there are people who don't have the things that I have. And also that because we're Christian people, that means something to us. It calls us to something. And, as an elementary school student, I was bused across town in Wilmington, which has a very racially charged history. I was bused across town to what was my elementary school had once been the all black high school in Wilmington. And so I feel like those, looking back on it, I think those experiences shaped me a lot. But as a university student, and then as a divinity student, I feel like really actually my faith wasn't really formed until I became a divinity school student. So I was studying Christianity on a graduate level. I feel like above all things, that's what div school did for me, was form my faith. And I learned from people, I learned from people who helped me put a Christian story, person of Jesus, into a very alive and contemporary context. And so it helped me connect a lot of the things that I'd lived through as a kid, and then as a university student at a Southern institution that has a lot of racial history, as most of our Southern institutions do. And to put those things in context with what I think about God, what I believe about God. And so it was my coursework, but it was also, some of the practical experience that I had. I was able to, I was a ministry intern for Bishop William Barber for a summer, before Poor People's Campaign. This was 20 years ago. That had a profound effect on me. I spent a summer in South Africa, learned about different contexts of racialized violence there, and all those things just shaped me a lot. And so I would often say, like, once you see things a particular way, once you see these things at work in your own life and the world around you, you can't unsee them. You see them all the time. And so that's sort of how it's come about for me.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. This one of Wilberforce, what a name, is 19th century fellow who is that basically, is the quote attributed to him is, once you've seen something, you can't unsee it. Mm-hmm. I'm sure many other philosophers and theologians and thinkers of the world realize that, because we don't know what we don't know, but once we know what we know, then
you can't
undo that.
Exactly.
At that point, you can only deny and maybe rationalize, justify, do other things like that, but you are now, you are aware and you can't undo that. So, so you were with Reverend Barber 20 years ago. I have only seen him speak in person at St. John the Divine Cathedral in New York City a couple of years ago. He was a guest preacher there. And
I think I was the sound tech.
You were, you were there that day. It was, he knows how to preach.
I didn't amplify it very much.
No, you didn't. And I was going to say, that's a challenging scenario for a sound tech.
Yeah.
He delivers a message. You don't walk away going, what did he say? I'm not sure.
No, it's really prophetic. I mean, I don't use that lightly. Like, it really is like,
no, it is.
It is.
Yeah.
So for you to spend a summer with him. Yeah, absolutely. I can imagine that would be, quite honestly, a life-changing experience. So,
No, it's like, so many things about that. I mean, even the very first day of being his intern, you know, he says, all right, meet me in the church parking lot at 7:30 a.m. And so we get in his minivan, and I'm driving us around, and he can drive all around Goldsboro, and he knows every neighborhood. And, you know, this used to be a middle-class white neighborhood. Now it's a low-income African-American neighborhood. They go to this elementary school, this middle school, this high school. And I had no concept that those were things that a pastor should know. You know, why does that, I mean, you need to know how to preach and visit people in the hospital and that kind of stuff. But what does school districts have to do with ministry? And so he helps show me what real prophetic community ministry is, and link it between, cause his point was, you know, if I have kids in my congregation who are going to a substandard school, it's a pastoral care issue for me to stand for them in their, and advocate for them. And so, it just connected, it just opened my mind completely and shaped what I think a pastor's job is. And obviously, you know, bearing witness to his gifts and his intellect, throughout that time, and the disciplines that he kept, you know, were very formative too, for sure.
That is so cool. I remember reading the scene in your book where you got the map out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Of a connection between spiritual salvation, what we think of, and its embodiment, that it's connected to, like, it's actually connected to bodies in houses in neighborhoods, was kind of, sounded like it was kind of a revelatory moment.
Oh yeah. I mean, you know, there's no class you can take that, can give you a learning experience like that. And so, you know, sometimes I feel like, you know, the people that I mean, really, we're all a product of our teachers to some degree, no matter what those teachers are. And so, I've been very fortunate to have some teachers that, that showed me, a really, creative and, I think, faithful way, to go about ministry. It's not easy. I mean, there's no, that summer, along with some others, totally changed the course of my life, changed who I am as a person, all of those things.
So flashing forward, because, you know, I want to get into some of the nitty gritty of the, this process of deconstructing, is once you become aware of your privilege, of your place, or, you know, social location, beyond just being aware of it, how does one then start that process of deconstructing? And I don't know if it's becoming someone else or giving away part of someone else, or like even how we conceive of that deconstruction.
It's a good question. I mean, I do think it, I guess I would say it, it happens both internally and externally, right? Like you are, I mean, those of us who are socialized in a white patriarchal culture, which ours American culture is, or have that so ingrained in us that by the time we come to awareness of it, there are certain viewpoints and certain postures that we are going to spend the rest of our life unlearning. Mm-hmm. You know, one of professors in DIPSC, we used to say, you know, if you're raised in the South, then racism was in the air you breathed, it was in the water you drank. You took it in without knowing it. Mm-hmm. And so there are ways of seeing other people, ways of seeing the world, ways of doing theology that all have to be unlearned in the interest of seeing the fullness of the world and seeing the world that exists outside of patriarchal white supremacy, which has always been there. But when you are acculturated in it, it sort of puts boundaries, it puts walls up between you and the rest of the world, between you, even you and your neighbors. Mm-hmm. You can't see and you can't understand their worldview clearly, but it can also be some kind of like mindset change. You have to actually live differently. It matters, you know, in the book, some folks are, I'm talking about this from a pastor's point of view, but most people aren't pastors, right? They're real estate agents, they're, physician's assistants, they're, teachers, they're, business owners, whatever they are. And every one of us has, none of the things that I just named are things that aren't touched by patriarchal white supremacy in some ways. And so every one of us has an opportunity in whatever we do, to undermine, to take down, to deconstruct those systems and the way they're at work in whatever place we live and work. So, then depending on what my location is, what my social location is, where are my opportunities for living this out in a real tangible way.
Mm-hmm. Well, that so well said. I, as you were sharing, I just was meditating a moment for what you said, for anybody that, grows up in the South, racism is a part of their upbringing. It's in the air they breathe and the water they drink. And I've not thought about that. And, you know, I grew up in Missouri, so same thing. And, you know, I was aware of it, but I've not leveled it up to, I have through thinking and meditating, but just to the way you said it, that so many folks don't even realize that it is interstitial to our being and our creation. Like it is in us. Mm-hmm. And it made me think a little bit about how we even inherit trauma from previous generations that it carries forth, and that could be the white privilege as well, because, you know, here we are three white guys having a conversation about this, but, you know, if we are rigorously honest with ourselves, we see the privilege that was given to us just because of, the skin we are, born into, and it just things are different because of that. Mm-hmm. And, as you said, it can't be just an internal, mindset, but also how we even live our lives and how we embody ourselves with our community and our culture. So, yeah.
You know, and it's interesting that, you know, you think of racism and its history in the South gets talked about a lot. There's another version of it in the North. Oh, I grew up in Northern Indiana in a town that had like four Black families.
Yeah.
And out of like 30,000 people.
Yep.
And there was this kind of idea of like, we're not racist because, you know, we're not practicing racism. It's like, well, right. Why are there only four Black families in this town?
Yeah.
There's something going on that's creating this, like, you know, that's making it uninviting and unwelcoming. But there's also this sense of like, oh, we were on the right side of the Civil War and, you know, we're progressive. Mm-hmm. We've done all these things and still completely blind to a lot of the things that, you know, like people of color in that town had to do in order to be, you know, just even to go to a job interview or, you know, there's something like that. There's a lot of this kind of like ingrained quiet racism that still exists, even, you know, even in northern communities. So I don't want to completely absolve them or burden it up on the South.
I, you know, I'll share too on that. I lived in St. Louis from 2013 until 2017, early when I came back to New York City. And in that 4 years, I've been away for a lot of years. I'd moved away, lived in California, lived in New York for 20 some years before I did this. It was back there. And this is, I was living in St. Louis when Michael Brown was killed. And I've shared on this before, like, it was devastating to me to see how the entire community it just fractured in different ways. Like, they could, you know, and even my friends and some family members were like on one side or the other, but because the majority were actually on the side of the cop, defending his actions of shooting down Michael in his back as he walked away from the cop car, right? And how they could justify that. And I thought, whoa, whoa, whoa. And then of course they would say, well, but I'm not racist. And I'm like, but you are, Blanche, but you are. You all are racist, you know, in the way that, as Kelly just described, in the most cynical way, because they don't know that they are. They actually, we decide that we're not because we're nice and we watch TV and we think we're hip and cool and everything else. But then also look how we live, because St. Louis is a shining example out of a lot of cities like that, where the only, like, this, the inner city, the city of St. Louis is, you know, the demographic is much different than if I went out to the suburbs and the counties where, you know, it is all white, and, you know, and everybody lives in their own little neighborhoods with their gates and everything else. And it's like, it's easy for you to say that, but how do you even, like, it's just, there's not even an attempt to understand what it is like for somebody else to live the way that Michael or anybody else in his situation or family. I'm not making a pass for what he did that led up to the situation. I mean, yes, he did something at the convenience store, but wow, it's just, and I was just heartbroken. I was like, oh my God. And that was one of the reasons why I actually moved back to New York City. I was like, yeah. I need to go back where I feel, safe is a strong word, but where I resonate better. So yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. And I would say that sort of colorblind racism, which is a term that other folks have used to talk about the kind of racism that persists, is actually just as dangerous, you know, as the Confederate flag waving, you know, folks in the American South that are pretty open about it. You know, it's done as much harm, and it actually perpetuates harm in so many ways, because we just don't have that willingness to tell, or ability, whatever you want to call it, to tell ourselves the truth about the things that are down deep in our spirits. That we want to deny or come up with a different name for it or whatever. I remember preaching a sermon one time about, I don't remember really what it was about, but I opened it talking about confession. Like, nobody, we were here talking about our inherent ability to let God down and to fall short of the love of God. We would all own that and say, yes, we're all sinners in need of grace. But if I asked you to get specific about the sin of racial prejudice that's in your spirit, you would battle me over that. You would fight me over that. It's like, why when we get specific, can we not still talk about sin and grace? Because we can't bear the truth sometimes about what's really there. Yeah.
That's a powerful thought.
True. Yeah. And that color blindness, you know, I've heard that. You know, having conversations with people who don't quite understand, you know, they say, like, why does it all have to be about race? Like, didn't we fix this? You know, the kind of like we did that.
Or the civil rights
thing. Didn't we fix this?
Yeah, like, you know, it's like, all, it was all done.
You know, everyone's got an equal opportunity now. And also, I mean, there's also the element of homophobia of, like, why are they always shoving it down our throats? Which is a metaphor that they use, but it's like, why do we always have to talk about
this? Is a family show, Kelly.
why do we always have to talk about their, you know, their sexual orientation or whatever? And and the kind of realization that glossing over everyone's differences creates a problem rather than admitting that different types of people have different types of experiences and that we need to recognize that and address it, that the color blindness or any other kind of blindness isn't essentially the goal.
Right. Yeah. Because when you live in a culture like ours where those things matter and you say you don't see that part of a person, then you're saying you don't see that part of their experience of the world, which means you don't see them. And there I understand where it comes from. But I think some of it is we just have to change the narrative, the truths that we tell, the half truths and the myths that we perpetuate. Those things have to be dealt with head on, which is why there are so many people right now fighting to keep those myths and those half truths alive in our school systems and stuff like that when we teach our history.
So Chris, to that end, I love the fact that we are talking about blindness, color blindness, but also, Kelly, as you drawn out about queer folks as well, as a queer blindness, or the choosing to not participate in, that it's like, oh, well, we just dealt with this, right? And why do you have to put it up in our face? So the book itself, Straight White Male, is the deconstruction, but you also interview folks that are in here, including Reverend Barber, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah. So, for example, I see here that you also have Robin Henderson Espinosa, who identifies as queer, non-binary Latinx. So what was the conversation like with Robin?
Well, so actually the way it was framed was that they were writing responses, essentially, to this concept. So it wasn't so much questions that I posed so much as an opportunity for these people to share their experience of the world, to let people like me who might be reading this book have an experience of the way that who they are matters and has shaped their life. Formerly Robin, now Roberto, changed their name and pronouns in the midst of the book being published. And in the podcast interview that I did with Roberto was like right after they announced this change in identity.
Yep.
And so I really wanted, and the other three contributors, we sort of isolated the variable, right? So there's somebody who's straight and white, but not male, somebody who's male and white, but not straight. I really wanted us to have someone who had sort of overlapping experiences of these things. And so, I think for those of us who are raised or again, socialized and really acculturated in heteronormativity, I think thinking about queerness is a real brain stretcher. And the conversation that I had with Roberto, I felt like if my brain were a muscle, I would have pulled it, just stretching me, because they're also intellectually and academically brilliant, a PhD and a scholar and all that. But learning to think outside of the binaries and categories that are so ingrained in us, and it's such an unnatural way for us, so many of us to think, but also really useful, opens up a whole nother world, whole nother way of seeing ourselves and everything when we get outside of that binary way of thinking. Yeah, really challenging. And I think when you talk to people like that and exposes sort of like how your view of the world is cutting you off from so many other aspects of the world that you live in. For me, my response to that is to be even more curious, like, because I don't want to miss anything. And I'm like, okay, well, let me learn to, I don't want this whole other world to pass by me without me being able to see it or experience it. So let me try to get outside of my conditioning, and see the world from somebody else's point of view. So, Roberto and Roberto's work, continues to challenge me a lot in lots of different ways.
So you're suggesting maybe we should check out Roberto, find him out on the internet. Does he have anything published?
Yeah. Right. So there's Activist Theology that was written under Robin, and then Body Becoming is their most recent book. And that's a really, another really challenging way of thinking about embodiment, both our individual, I don't know, it's just this really interesting way of thinking. And now actually science is teaching us this as well, is that like, actually most of us aren't just one body. Like at any one time, I might have more microbial cells on my body than I do human cells.
I love that idea too. Yeah. Yeah.
So walking,
this, we are walking, talking microbes. Absolutely. Yeah.
So then you talk about a body as a collection, right? Which is the body of Christ. The way we talk about church is this collection of people. And what is the, how does the way we think about our individual bodies, how does that apply? And when we think about our collective body and the health of our collective body. So definitely you can find Roberto's work in lots of different places. Yeah, my podcast conversation with them.
Absolutely.
And some other published things. Yeah.
Yeah. To be clear, let's call that out real quick, just, you know, just so that everybody knows it's listening. And of course, we'll put this in our episode notes about where we can find your work, Chris, as well as, you know, maybe we can find some other stuff about Roberto. But yeah, definitely, you know, this is why we have these kinds of conversations. You know, we're here to explore, right? And like you said, you know, step outside of our little boxes. So, Kelly, what are you doing?
Well, one of the things I want to do is commend you, you know, in your book, you say that you're not necessarily, I'm not going to get the quote quite right, but you're necessarily a theologian, but more of a preacher. But there's a lot of, you know, books and works that I've read, but that are very specific about breaking down, you know, the clobber passages in the Bible, about, you know, about being gay and, you know, what that meant in that context of the time, et cetera. I think you did a really great job of just of kind of like an introduction to those topics. So if there's somebody, you know, listening who's, you know, more conservative, who's like, you know, being gay is a deal breaker for me because of, you know, Romans 1, I can't get any further than that. I highly recommend to read your book, because I think it really gives a good kind of icebreaker to that conversation for somebody to be like, oh, maybe there is some other context to that. Maybe I do need to open my eyes a little bit. So I just, as I was going through that, I was like, this is fantastic. I want to start sharing this with some people. So
I appreciate that. I mean, I definitely was doing theology in the book. I would say, I wouldn't say I'm a biblical scholar in that sense, certainly not a Paul scholar.
That's what I should have said.
Well, yeah, you know, that's different. I wanted to make that disclaimer, because the other thing about writing a book like this is that you're apt to be wrong, you know, in somebody's eyes about something. Even people who would ideologically agree with me wouldn't necessarily agree or think that I was an expert on this particular topic. So, which I'm, you know, I was trying to model that a little bit in the way I framed it. And I also wanted to write, I think that was one of the ways that my editor really helped me, was to clarify, you know, write this for someone who is just coming to wrestle with these. Not everybody's been thinking about this stuff their whole adult lives. Lots of people are coming to this newly. And so try to meet them where they are if they're picking up this book. And so that was a helpful way of framing it. You know, if I was talking to myself at the beginning of this, what would I say? So I appreciate that. I'm glad it was, you found it effective. It's good.
Yeah. And it's really accessible. So I would highly recommend it to somebody who wants to learn more and explore the topic.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'm looking at one of the reviews that you have on Amazon. It says, Reverend Furr shares much of his own story with the reader, giving us a glimpse of his vulnerabilities, as well as sharing stories of scripture and how Jesus teaches us to break down structures of patriarchy, masculinity, and white supremacy. This book is full of difficult lessons that we all need to learn, regardless of our demographic. It is very readable as well. Books on this topic can often be dense and slow, but not this one. And he says you keep it moving along and highly recommend it. So there you are.
Nice.
You get all of those ringing endorsements from Amazon, right?
Yeah.
I'll take it. I'll take it for sure. Yeah. you get the other side too. So the good ones you try to soak in.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. What, Craig? Yeah, he gave you 1 stars and he just yells at you, man up.
Yeah. there's certainly that element. Truthfully, when I published the book, I thought I would get more of that. I have, I guess, you know, that's the price of not being a bestseller, right? You don't get, you know. You can get a lot of success, but you can get a lot of targeting too. But I don't know. That's I guess the thing about the book is that from the very beginning, you know, there's people who aren't going to read it, who are not, they're not open enough intellectually or spiritually or emotionally to be prepared to take it in. Or even if it's something they come away disagreeing with, to really process what I'm saying and think through it. So, you can't lose a lot of sleep about that. I actually think that this kind of self-examination and truth-telling, requires a lot more courage, than maybe the definition of man that Craig is describing. I don't get too spun up about that type of stuff.
I'm glad you don't, because I threw it out there a little bit lighthearted, only because, you know, it's like, all right, really, you have nothing else to say except man up. So,
well, but, yeah. And I mean, I'll comment on something you haven't read clearly. So, you know,
right. There's that.
Right. He had a point. He's like, you're treading on my manhood.
Yeah. Yes, don't try to let manhood. Oh my gosh. So Chris, this book is obviously a great read, but it does push buttons and it's going to be uncomfortable. And, you know, I salute you for doing that, because the only way we make progress is when we unfortunately have to push the needle. That's just how it kind of goes. And here you are. My point to all of that is, in your own, you have a congregation, you're a pastor. Does your own community resonate with this book, and how do you weave this into that story with your own congregation?
That's a good question. I mean, by and large, the congregation has been really supportive and encouraging, and you know, they bought the book and they were proud of me and all those things, even if there were things that, you know, in it that might have pushed some of them one direction. I think one of the most meaningful parts of it was one of our young adults, she's probably in her mid-20s, who I saw her with a copy of it, and it was dog-eared and highlighted to death. And I was just, mm-hmm. It just made my heart swell, you know, to think, gosh, you know, somebody's really diving into this and finding meaning in it. And you know, you can have a New York Times bestseller, I guess, but that means as much as anything. So they've been really supportive. And I would also say that, like, a lot of, living through and pastoring through the Trump years, which I guess are ongoing in many ways, but was certainly kind of a laboratory for a lot of these things. Begin to think through and see. I mean, that's how the book starts, is in the introduction, sort of talking about the day after the 2016 election and how it sort of pierced the veil that I might have had about the world we live in and helped me acknowledge some realities. And so over the next, you know, since then, in many ways, it's, you know, I think as a pastor, it's been about helping people to process this world and tell the truth about it and find out what our calling is in it. And so, you know, it's one of the things, one of the reasons that I give thanks for that, for the church, for Covenant Christian Church in the book, is that, you know, they really let me be me. And that's kind of been the case since I got there 9 years ago. They've let me be me and push their buttons. And that's not an experience that every pastor has. So I'm grateful for that.
Yeah. Not everybody comes to church to be challenged.
No,
it's true.
Most people don't, actually.
No, that's no. Right. We can't speak for years, but you know,
check the box.
Yeah.
Have a cup of coffee and go home.
Our respective denomination, that shall not be named for the moment, but we see quite a few of that. You know, people, you know, they want to participate, but they don't want to be challenged. So it's a soothing experience that they seek, and maybe in oneness. I mean, especially for the Eucharist, you know, there are those moments, but yeah.
One thing that I do want to also talk about is sexism, because you know we've kind of covered. You know, we got three guys here. We covered a couple of different topics, but we haven't really talked about, like the work that Melissa brought to the to the book. And also, I mean, that's one of those topics that, you know, for me as straight white male, that, you know, I look back through my history and I'm like, I know that I have been sexist. I know that I have objectified people. Like, I meant well, but I, you know, even like on a microaggression level, I know that I necessarily really want to be better.
Absolutely. And can I step in as the token, the queer guy here, but representing this, but that is not whether you are, wherever you are in your identity, because I too, you know, full confession, I reflect back, I have more than one cringeworthy memory of when I've done something that was, you know, it was sexist in its nature, either in a micro way or there are a couple I'm just not flat ass proud of, like, dang, you know, just being a male can.
I mean, it's, go ahead.
I was just going to say, what were some of the things that you discovered or uncovered in this part of the book?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that I've thought a lot about is how patriarchy in our, I mean, it's certainly harmful to women in our culture, right? I mean, we know the statistics on domestic violence and sexual violence, and, you know, those things are, I think I bring those forward in the book and talk about the ways that, again, the experience of a woman in the world is just much different. You know, I don't think about anything when I enter a stairwell. I don't think about anything in a parking deck at night. I don't think about, you know, walking, you know, with my key between my fingers at night or whatever things women have to think about when they try to think about their own safety. And so, that means that we live in different worlds. And even, you know, even like listening and talking to a lot of the women that are in ministry, and some of the experiences that they have had in places that are, again, it's not a question about whether women can be ordained or called to ministry. We've settled that question, but there's still gross stuff that happens all the time to them that casts the shadow on their ministry, and that's so harmful and so dehumanizing. But I also think the other side of it is that the way we conceive of masculinity is also very dehumanizing for people who are male. You know, like Craig's comment about man up. Well, Craig has one conception of what it means to be a man, and how many people have been diminished because they've been made to feel like there's only one way that they can actualize this part of themselves, that they have to play a sport, or they have to, you know, be willing to fight, or they have to whatever thing that we think about as like a macho type of thing. And or even within the church, when you talk about, you know, males are groomed for leadership. Well, not all of us are called to leadership. So why are we trying to? So it's done so much harm. And I think that's the thing that, it's an undercurrent for all of those sections, is that all of these things, they're harmful to other people, but they're also hurting us in ways that we're not fully, maybe haven't been fully aware of. You know, I would say masculinity is the thing, same thing, especially as somebody who is the father to two boys who are now adolescents and coming to this struggle of discovering who they are and, you know, what their how they want to live out their identity in the world. Who are they? And then wanting them to have freedom to do that and not say, well, this is what you have a penis. And so you have to be like this, you know? And that's just so limiting. And so why, you know, I just don't see why that's so important, to people. And I'm sorry if I'm talking a lot, but, this gets me fired up. I mean, I'm a person who always wants to know why. So like, if you tell me that, that one word that describes something is bad, another word that describes the same thing is permissive. Like you can say poop, but you can't say the S word. Why? Who said that one was okay and one isn't? Like, who decided? I want to know who decided before I decide whether I'm going to follow this rule or not. And so we have these conceptions about what a man is and what masculinity is. Well, a man does this and a man does this and a man does this. Well, I want to know who decided and why. You know, why is it that, you know, why is it important that a man wear their hair short? Why is it important that a woman shaves their legs? Like, why do we have these expectations around gender? And why have we accepted them as scientific fact, as cold, hard truth, when all that they are cultural creations that we have just accepted as customs and live into them, and never stop to ask ourselves whether they're serving us well? And if they're not serving us well, then why do we keep doing them? And so that's where I come to this conversation around masculinity. And I'm like, there's so many reasons, if we care about and love our neighbors, there's so many reasons to be free of this. But also love your neighbor as yourself, and love yourself enough to free yourself from this confining version of masculinity that you're constantly having to prove, right, to someone else.
Yeah, it can be very, and honestly, it can be very limiting. You know, I've been to, you know, men's meetings where, you know, guys get together and just talk about their lives. And it's interesting, like guys that are like big, husky, stereotypical construction workers and gym teachers and stuff like that get real tender when it's just us guys. Like you talk about things that would change your reputation and image if you talked this openly or vulnerably in the world, but the world expects a certain kind of tough exterior shell. Like we all have to be a Ford F-150 with the right stickers on it, just in our bodies. And
150s or wusses, it needs to be at least a 250 or maybe.
Well, and that's where, like, the point I keep coming back to in the book, like there's some things that are like, I feel like are common to all three of these things. But like, if you accept God's radical love for you, to use, you know, the name of this podcast, if you accept the extravagant, unconditional love that God has for you, then what are you trying to prove to anyone about being worthy of being feared or admired or loved or whatever it is? And so there's so much with the cultural expectations about being a man and being a woman that are putting this expectation on us that you have to earn something by the truck you drive or the way you dress or how big your muscles are or whatever it is. And it's like, you know, God's given you the means by which to be free of that. And what would your life be like if you were free of trying to prove something to someone about what kind of man you are? How would that make your life softer, more meaningful, less anxious, less fearful, if you really could believe that God loves you as you are? If you could really believe that in a way, and you know, in a way that you can put down some of these, you know, these desires to put crazy Amazon reviews on messages about man up, You know, if you could just, if you could, I mean, imagine walking around, Craig, walking around all day feeling like, got a man up. And it's like, man, okay. You know, just take a breath. It's all right.
And he's threatened by you breaking ranks.
Oh, yes.
Thing is, like, he wants you to do it too. Like, yes. It's not just him, but
that's exactly right.
Don't give away the secret or whatever.
That's right. You need to man up.
Yeah. Yeah. No, Jared Yates Sexton. I don't know if that's a guy that you guys know, but he's kind of a political commentator and writer. He has a really good book out on masculinity that I drew a lot from. And he talks about how nobody gets as angry as when a straight white male breaks rank, you know, mm-hmm. and steps outside and starts to tell some of the truths or live out of the norm. No, there's a lot of ways that people are threatened by that breaking rank. It seems like if you had some self-awareness, you would maybe ask, like, why do I feel so threatened by one person being different from what I think the norm is?
Yeah.
Wow. You, just by saying that, and this is another episode that we could do, but just talking through masculinity, breaking rank, and does this, what drives some of the homophobia, sexism, everything else? And I'm sure the answer is yes in some ways in that, mm-hmm. but just because the point you bring there, is so, yeah, of course, because if you're threatened by that, well, then you need to ask yourself, why are you threatened by this?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's where, like, as I'm like continuing to think through this work, you know, what is it that can help move this work forward? And I think, a lot of these things actually, they masquerade as strength and toughness and hate and all kinds of things, but it's really fragility and woundedness, I think, that are underneath all of it. Because if you, and this was like James Baldwin helped me to think about this. He had this conversation where he was like, you know, the only way that we're going to solve the race problem is for white people to understand why they need me to be. He used the N word, but he's like, why you need me to be that? I'm not that. I'm a man. I'm a person. I'm a human being. I'm not that. In a very true way, but you need to figure out why you need me to be that. And I think the answer is that a lot of us, are just not secure in who we are and how we are. So we can't accept that God's love for us is real, and true, just as we are. We can't imagine that somebody would love us just the way we are without being this or that thing. And so, so what does it mean to begin to heal that wound within us that is the source of so many of the ways we inflict this pain on other people, right? That's what we've done with it. We've taken this pain that we have about our own inadequacy and blown it through everybody else we could, you know, we could find, queer folks, women, people of color. So what would it mean for us to deal with this pain rather than trying to heal it in ways that we've seen don't actually work? Doesn't help us feel any better. Doesn't make us any better. So I think a lot about that now, about sort of as a culture, how do we begin to heal this wound that's in so many of us?
And it's not a new idea, although it's kind of new to, sure, to some of us, but the idea that the oppressor themselves are harmed by the oppression. It's counterintuitive.
Oh, so
but then when you start digging into it, you're like, oh yeah, that's where all this comes from. And that the idea that we ourselves need to heal in order to be better to others.
Yeah.
Well, it's as simple as what you learned when you were in elementary school about bullies, right? Like, bullies are people who are trying to make somebody else feel bad because of their own stuff. Like, underneath a bully is a deep wound, right? I mean, that's, we all, like, we're taught that when somebody was mean to us, it's like, well, they're being mean to you, but it really means that they feel bad about themselves, which doesn't necessarily help you when you're on the other end of it, but I think it's as simple as that and as complex as that. Like, there's, and this also to go back to what one of you said earlier about generational and how generational trauma is passed from one to another. It's so deep seated in us now, that, you know, so many men who were held hostage by a certain conception of masculinity, then pass that on and pass that on and pass that on, to the point where it's hard now for some folks to get free of it and break that cycle of what they inherited. So,
well said. That's very well said, Chris. Wow, what a conversation we've had.
Yes. Yeah, indeed.
Yeah,
I feel like we've covered a lot of ground.
We have. And Chris, as we're wrapping up here, I just, you know, again, thank you so much for honoring us with your time and to share about your book and your journey and your mission and your calling, right? You're definitely out in the world making things happen. So, you know, the title is Straight White Male, A Faith-Based Guide to Deconstructing Your Privilege and Living with Integrity. A powerful book, and it's not just for straight white male. I think it's a book for everybody.
Absolutely.
So, and it's published by Westminster John Knox. So get it on all available sites, right? You can get it through Amazon and wherever you buy books, you will find it. And you say also, is there a new audio version of it out?
Yeah, it's just come out. It's on Audible now. So those of you who are taking books that way can find it there as well.
Excellent. So where can folks find out more about your work that you're doing?
They can find me at chrisfurr.com. That's my website. It has the book and the podcast is there. You can get in touch with me there as well. There is a Facebook page, facebook.com/SWMFurr, F-U-R-R. I'm at Rev Furr on Instagram and on Twitter, X, whatever it is now. So you can find me in all those places.
Excellent. Chris, thank you very much for your time. I look forward to our paths crossing together. And, you know, as I say, Godspeed on your work here.
Great. Thanks for having me. And appreciate you all and the work that you're doing also. Best to you both.
Thank you very much, Chris.
To any of our listeners who are hearing this and want to be part of this conversation, you can find Radical Love Live on Facebook, on Instagram, and on the X Twitter.
That
craziness is over there. We're still there for at least the time being.
Yeah.
Right. But yeah, make sure if you have questions for us, if you have questions for Chris, you know, we'll make sure that to pass those along. But you can find us there if you want to join the conversation.
Sounds great.
All right. Be well, all. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Radical Love Live, co-hosted by Mark Dilcom and Kelly Wilson. All rights reserved. You can find our podcast on Spotify, Apple, Stitcher, and other popular podcast platforms. Go to radicallovelive.com to learn more about us, watch recordings of our live events, and listen to our podcast. We also invite you to check out what Kelly and Mark are doing by going to our websites. Find Kelly at kellywilson.com and Mark at markdilcom.com. This is Radical Love Live, where we explore faith outside the boxes.